Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the September 2024 edition of Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you once again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible that we can be here together today. I'm Rimley Crow. Today I am joined by Dr. Tony Fernandez, Jeff Rollman, and Bill Toon. And we are very excited, in fact, to have some of the authorship team here with us today. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Palatinas and Dr. Youngquist. As a reminder, the name of the article that we're reviewing is Early Intramuscular Adrenaline Administration is Associated with Improved Survival from Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, which was published in Resuscitation, hot off the press, in fact. And as always, our discussion today is going to be paired with an article written by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce. This will be in EMS World under the topic of Journal Watch. I encourage all of you who are listening to check it out at emsworld.com under the category of Education and Training. Thanks to those of you who are here live with us right now. For those of you who haven't been with us before, just a reminder that you can use the chat feature on your screen or the Q&A feature and type in any questions that you have, and we'll bring those into the discussion as we go. And without further ado, definitely want to dive right in and welcome our authors. So I would like to, for those of our audience who may not know you, let's do a little bit of an introduction. Tell us who you are, how you got into EMS research. So Dr. Youngquist, let's start with you. Welcome. Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks, Ramley. Happy to be here with you today. My name is Dr. Scott Youngquist, and I am an emergency physician. I did my medical school training at UCLA Medical School, and I did my residency in emergency medicine at Harbor UCLA, an affiliated county hospital in Torrance, California. It was actually the backdrop for the old movie Emergency. That was the stand-in for Rampart General. So I went to work every day at Rampart General while I learned emergency medicine. And then I did a two-year EMS research fellowship with Dr. Marianne Gauchet and did a master's in epidemiology also at UCLA before becoming faculty at the University of Utah. And here I am the medical director for the Salt Lake City Fire Department, their chief medical officer, and a clinical researcher mainly focused in cardiac arrest and pre-hospital care.
Fantastic. Thank you again for joining us and sharing your time. And Dr. Palatinas, same questions. Will you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got into EMS research?
Hi. I'm currently a junior faculty member at the University of Utah Department of Emergency Medicine. Recently completed a fellowship in resuscitation research. Prior to that, I had been practicing clinically in Los Angeles for several years, during which time I developed an affinity for understanding resuscitation research. Over the years, I decided to pivot and become more involved in actually performing the research. And at that time, I entered the fellowship at the University of Utah, focusing on studying interventions to improve cardiac arrest outcomes. So studying the IM epinephrine has been one of my focuses during this time.
We are delighted to have you here in the space of EMS research and very excited for this particular article. It's a lot to consider for us. But before we dive straight into methods and results, I'm always curious about how this project came about, what made you decide to take on this research question? So if any background that you have on why you decided to take this on.
Yeah, I'm happy to take that on. So I became interested in this particularly after the publication of the Paramedic 2 trial in the UK, which compared largely intravenous epinephrine to placebo in cardiac arrest. And it's basically the first study to show with a placebo-controlled clinical trial that epinephrine was a life-saving drug. The survival at 30 days was higher with epinephrine than with placebo. And so with any intervention that we show to be life-saving, like defibrillation, there's always a consideration of how do we get this in the hands of BLS providers and how do we give it early? There's substantial epidemiologic literature that shows that the earlier epinephrine is administered, the better the survival from cardiac arrest. So it makes sense that getting this on board early, the earlier pressor effect, which we know improves rates of return of spontaneous circulation and survival to hospital discharge, requires a rethinking of exactly how we administer it. And the biggest hurdle to administering the epinephrine is getting an ALS person on scene and having them establish vascular access and give the medication. In the paramedic 2 trial, the median interval from 999 call, which is their 911, to the administration of the drug, it occurred at 21 and a half minutes. So a pretty good example of how long it takes in the field to get that first dose of epinephrine on board compared to laboratory studies, you know, where it's really controlled, there's already vascular access. So we had trained our EMTs to deliver anaphylaxis dose epinephrine by drawing it into a syringe. And so my thought was, well, we should study whether IM epinephrine can achieve earlier pressor effects, earlier return of spontaneous circulation, better survival. There was some animal literature to back this idea up. This wasn't, this didn't occur to me de novo. There was some pig studies and rat studies demonstrating a beneficial effect of IM epinephrine in that model of cardiac arrest. So translating that into humans became the idea for giving it in this particular study.
I love that. And this is a great example of changing the system to get a different result. In a lot of areas where there's not access to an ALS ambulance, this can have a huge effect. So I like that that was part of the consideration to this project. Now, I know our listeners are really chomping at the bit to find out, does IM Epi have an association with survival to discharge? But first, before we ever review results, we like to spend some time in the methods section and understanding what does the system look like, where this took place, what were the methods, so that when we're interpreting those results, we can consider how this may or may not apply to other systems. So for that, I'm going to invite Dr. Fernandez to join us and walk through some of the methodology with you all.
Well, fantastic. And I want to thank both of our authors again for joining us today. I think this is a really cool study, and I'm excited to talk to you about the results and the study at large. So let's go ahead and dive right in. Can you tell us, so we talked about the impetus for this study and some of the background research you did. So can you tell us specifically, what was your study objective and some of the outcomes that you decided to investigate?
So this was a before and after study to assess the impact of introducing early IM epinephrine as an adjunct to ACLS care. Our primary objective is to assess the effectiveness of this intervention in terms of improvements in survival to hospital admission, but our secondary aims were to understand its effect on neurologically intact outcomes, as well as survival to hospital discharge.
Fantastic. And so the study was done in Salt Lake City with Salt Lake City Fire Department, and you looked at data between January 2010 and May 2024. Can you tell us a little about Salt Lake City Fire Department and the population you serve?
Correct. So Salt Lake City Fire Department cares for Salt Lake's population of Salt Lake City, Utah, which is approximately 200,000 individuals. The agency itself is a two-tiered municipal agency that has both BLS and ALS providers that respond from 14 stations throughout the city. They field about 33,000 calls annually and use a 911 dispatch center. So calls that come into the dispatch center that are identified as a potential cardiac arrest, the nearest unit, whether it's BLS or ALS, is dispatched to the scene. And then following that, additional ALS support is deployed to the scene as well. They approach the cardiac arrest through a pit crew approach where each health provider is pre-assigned to a specific therapeutic task, whether That'd be administrating CPR and medication administration, documentation, or monitoring the rhythm and providing defibrillations. Usually these crews can consist of anything from 6 to 10 providers, with about an average of about 8 providers. Overall, the agency sees up to 130 cardiac arrests annually.
Fantastic. There's a wealth of information there, particularly for this study. So as we move right through, right, you had a definition, and everyone who listens to this podcast regularly knows how I love definitions, particularly when they're stated in your method section. So you defined cardiac arrest as a pulselessness requiring EMS administered chest compressions or bystander shock. I think that's pretty easy to understand and well stated. How did you come up with can you tell us a little bit about your inclusion criteria and who was eligible to be included in your study?
So we included all non-traumatic adult consecutive cardiac arrests that took place between the study period of January 2010 to May 2024. We decided to exclude traumatic causes of a cardiac arrest, given their different mechanism. They had a different mechanism of injury, and we also excluded those involving strangulation, drowning, and then those who had return to spontaneous circulation prior to administration of epinephrine, and then those that had a DNR order. We also excluded patients who received epinephrine prior to EMS arrival. For example, patients who went into cardiac arrest at outpatient nursing facilities or surgical centers.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. And you specifically stated that because there was not a lot of supporting evidence for this study for the intervention specifically, you didn't calculate a sample size, but rather went with a convenient sample. And I think that is perfectly acceptable for this study. I think that's there's not much other choice for where we are. And I love that this study brings out more questions than we might investigate. As we move through, can you tell us specifically what was your intervention, and how did you break up your time periods?
Correct. So prior in November 2019, there was a change in clinical practice guidelines, as discussed by Dr. Youngquist. So the pre-intervention period encompassed January 2010 to the date that started the intervention, which was the December 1st, 2019. During the pre-intervention period, all cardiac arrest patients received their epinephrine through standard care, which was either through an IV or IO vascular access. Following that change in clinical practice in December of 2019, the guidelines stated that all patients' cardiac arrest received their initial dose of epinephrine immediately followed by IV or IO epinephrine once vascular access was established.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that. When she says immediately, we mean like after the first rhythm analysis. So our guidelines were, if it's a shockable rhythm, wait till the second rhythm analysis. And if the patient remains pulseless at the second, give it. If it is recognized as a non-shockable rhythm, then give it as immediately. So, and then further doses were given through the IV or IO route. And we left that to paramedic discretion to determine what was the most feasible point of access, either IV or IO. And I'll add that most of our IO is a tibial IO in Salt Lake City. So we haven't adopted a humeral IO approach. It's one that is a little bit more difficult to acquire in the field, and also is prone to failure during the cardiac arrest, according to literature. So we mostly were like 80% tibial IO and 20% IV access for further doses of epinephrine, just to contextualize that.
And actually, the dose we gave was a 5 milligram dose. And we had used that dose based on the guidance that no more than 5 mLs of volume be given through the vastus lateralis muscle. So based on the current formulation of epinephrine, which is 1 milligram per ml, it came out to be 5 milligrams, which based on extrapolation from anaphylaxis literature comes out to be about 0.5 milligrams IV equivalent dose.
Yeah, it sounds like a whopping dose, but in the pig literature, when they were giving IM doses, they were actually giving the equivalent of 10 milligrams intramuscularly. So this was dialed back a little bit from that, but given the volume considerations for large muscle intramuscular dosing, we chose the 5 milligram dose and to start with.
Excellent. Really interesting how you went about that. And you didn't just tell your folks, hey, we're going to start giving epi IM and let's go ahead and go, right? You gave them some didactic and clinical trainings. Can you tell us a little bit about how you trained your folks to prepare for the study?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a combination of learning management system videos that went out and then live in-person training to make sure everybody understood what was going on. There was some testing afterwards to make sure crews got it. And then there was very close quality assurance process where we closely examined the first cases. And frankly, throughout, we've closely been watching for mistakes or anything like that, and didn't see any mistakes. The biggest mistake we saw was actually not administering the IM epinephrine, so crews falling back on old ways of doing things and forgetting to introduce the early dose. So that was the only protocol deviation we observed in this entire process.
Yeah, and you just teed up my next question for me. When there were those protocol deviations, how did you handle that in the analysis?
So all of our crews get direct feedback on every single cardiac arrest case, which includes the quality of CPR from their monitor defibrillator, the decision making regarding shock analysis and shock delivery, the outcomes of the patient. We give feedback to the dispatchers regarding bystander CPR. So as part of that, we also reminded them that, hey, you missed an opportunity to give this early dose, which we think would benefit patients.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And am I correct that you actually made some adjustments in the analysis too, where you, if there was a protocol deviation, they got IV or IO rather than IM, you switched them into the what is essentially the pre-group. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah. And I think that was a great decision. So we always like to know where and how you obtain the data. And I know you went through the Salt Lake City Fire Department Cardiac Arrest Registry. Can you tell us a little bit about the registry and how difficult or easy it was to obtain these data for this study?
So the cardiac. Sure.
Oh, do you want to talk about that, Helen? Or?
Oh, you can go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is something that I set up way back in 2008 was when we first started collecting data on cardiac arrest. And it was before the state of Utah adopted CARES statewide. So we really mirrored the CARES elements in Salt Lake City, which follow an Utstein-style reporting template. Utstein is just the name we give to the agreed upon approach to definitions of different variables in cardiac arrest, like witnessed arrest, what constitutes a cardiac arrest, et cetera. So we adopted that and we're collecting data all along the way. We have a fairly robust database that we use a program called REDCap that the University of Utah uses for data entry, and it's a secure web-based portal for archiving all of this data. And then we downloaded it in order to run the statistical analysis. For outcomes, we used a combination of approaching EMS liaisons at different hospitals to get the outcomes of patients. And also the state of Utah developed a community health information exchange in which almost all medical records from hospitalizations are accessible through this portal. And so as a quality assurance officer, I'm able to go in or one of my delegates and get outcomes for paramedics, whether it be cardiac arrest or, they're just interested in what happened to a particular case. So we get a ton of requests from our paramedics to find out what happened to patient X who went to hospital Z. And we're usually able to give them that feedback. So it's a nice data set.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like you have a wealth of information there. And so I always have the unenviable task of holding us up before we get to our really interesting results. But I did want to just mention with the statistical analysis, you didn't just look at the root in a vacuum. You ran some adjusted models. And can you tell us some of the things that you adjusted for in your logistic regression models?
Yeah, so our primary outcome was actually survival to hospital discharge. And we adjusted for some factors that variables that were considered to be common confounders that would potentially affect our independent and dependent variables. And we adjusted for age, presence of bystander CPR, sex, witness arrests, whether or not they had a shockable versus non-shockable initial rhythm, the location of the arrest, as well as the response time.
Well, really important things to account for in your analysis, absolutely. So before we jump into these results, I just want to open it up to the rest of the panelists and see if there are any methods related questions still out there. And if not, again, I want to say I really enjoyed reading this study, and I'm looking forward to sharing the results with the rest of our audience.
Yeah, I certainly agree that this was an excellent study, and definitely I'm glad to hear that you did this, and we're very honored to have you on with our podcast, Dr. Youngquist and Dr. Palatinas. Quick question about your system design, since we have many paramedic students, EMTs, paramedics all over the country, and they're probably thinking, how would this work in my system? And how does Salt Lake City compare with their local department? And I was wondering, with your two-tiered system and what your EMTs or paramedics do, are your EMTs doing maybe advanced skills like putting in IOs or doing some things that might affect how quickly they're able to provide ACLS? Or would you say that most of your first responders on scene are doing strictly BLS measures? Just trying to get a better idea of sort of what the care pathway looks like in practical terms.
Yeah, I can talk about that. We have we use medical priority dispatch to code calls and determine whether the response is going to be a BLS or ALS response. For a BLS first on scene provider, they're instructed to give 30 to 2 CPR and attach the AED, do rhythm analysis and shock. They're not allowed to establish vascular access in our system, so they do have to wait until ALS providers get there. For this study, as a first step, we put this early intervention actually in the hands of our ALS providers. So even though the long-term outlook of this is, hey, if this works, this could be something for BLS providers, we decided to start with ALS providers administering the intervention when they arrive first on scene.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, that definitely answers a very reasonable approach. And for people thinking about what they're doing, is this, you know, too crazy in Salt Lake City? No, absolutely not. You're just utilizing your resource as well. Thank you.
Well, hearing no other methods questions, I say we start talking about some of these results.
I like that idea. If you'll flip us over to figure one, we can dive in with who ended up in the study. This is always a really important figure for us to look at reading any research paper. So we can see that there's over 1,400 patients included in this. It's a very busy system, it sounds like. And one of the things that stuck out to me in this part was, we already hinted at it, but the adherence to the new protocol was around 90%. I'm curious from you all, are there any lessons learned during this that if another agency was going to implement or replicate this approach, is there anything that you learned during this process that you would use to increase adherence to the protocol, or is 90% about where you expected the adherence to be?
Honestly, it may be higher than I expected it to be. Salt Lake City Fire is a great system with great, really caring paramedics. But with any training, there's always people who just kind of miss it, or, you know, they go back to their instinctual training, particularly ones, you know, paramedics that have been doing it for a long time. It's sort of like a reflex to go to what you've been doing for quite a while. So I was actually pleasantly surprised at how much adherence we had to it. And, you know, and it's something that over time gets better with directed feedback. So I really don't expect paramedics to do anything 100% of the time when something new is introduced. But at this point, they are really 100% doing it. So it's one of those things that compliance has only gone up instead of down from that 90%.
Absolutely. And I think that feedback and closed loop communication is a key piece to making sure that there's not what we call like an improvement science, the shift and drift effect. A new intervention comes, we're very excited about it. Initially, adherence is great. And then sometimes it wanes over time. But with your approach following up, I think that's helping sustain those incredible results. So next thing I want to talk about now that we see the table or the figure here, 985 patients ended up in the control cohort with the caveat that we discussed that some patients were reallocated based on what treatment they actually received. And then 420 received the new intervention, with 11 having that IM epi only, and then the rest of the patients having additional epinephrine by other routes after that initial IM dose. The next thing that we look at in reading a research paper is typically table one, looking at the characteristics of the patients. So if we flip over to table one, I'm curious to hear from the authors first. I have my own thoughts on a couple of things I picked out, but when we compare these two populations, were there any differences that jumped out to you or anything that we should take into consideration as we're thinking about the control cohort and then that cohort that received the intervention?
So there were two notable differences. The group that received the intervention were slightly younger population, and it's unclear what caused this difference is. We do know that the intervention period took place during COVID-19 pandemic, and during that time we were seeing cardiac arrests from both your traditional cohort as well as patients who were had COVID-19 related complications. So that can drive the age down. In addition, we are also seeing a larger population of opioid-induced cardiac arrest. So I think both COVID-19 population as well as the opioid epidemic could potentially affect our age.
Yeah. So for those listening and not watching the podcast that's in the IM cohort, the mean age was 56.5 years, and for the IVIO first cohort it was 59.5 years. So there was a 3-year difference, 3 years younger basically in the IM population. And as Helen said, you know, we're like everywhere, we're seeing more of the cardiac arrest cause of arrest taken up with fentanyl and heroin overdoses. So that may contribute to that over time. There's one thing we know about temporal trends, it's that they change over time. So the cohort from the past is not going to look exactly the same as the present or the future.
Absolutely. But having these clearly displayed in a table like you've done allows us to think about, well, what effect, if any, might this have had on results, and what should we be considering for the future? So I really like how you all laid out the comparison here so that it's very clear for us.
And Helen, can you mention the other ones?
Yeah, so there was also a difference in the bystander CPR. About 56% in the standard care cohort received bystander CPR compared to 69, almost 70% of patients in the intervention group. And we know that bystander CPR can have a significant impact on our cardiac outcomes. And that could be due to a couple of different reasons. Later on during the study period, there was increased training of their dispatchers, and they were encouraged, they had additional training in instructing callers to perform bystander CPR. Also, we became more proactive in reviewing the dispatch files. Bystander CPR used to be documented through dispatch records. And now we're using multiple different sources to identify cases where a dispatcher, where bystander CPR took place. So could also be due to increased training as well as initial misclassification in the earlier part of the study.
A great one to keep in mind for sure.
Yeah, I wanted to jump in real quick and ask about the bystander CPR, since I'm very glad that you brought that up and we're discussing it. And just looking at these numbers, I was blown away. I mean, most studies that I've seen, bystander CPR rates are maybe 25, 30, 40, maybe 50%. But even in your pre-period, above 50%, I mean, really high bystander CPR rates. And I was wondering you're doing something really well in Salt Lake City. And I was thinking maybe, I know some systems, police will respond even before the fire department, and pretty much all police officers nowadays are trained in CPR. Maybe you had police officers going on these cardiac arrests, or how were you able to get those bystander rates so high, especially during the pandemic period when I would think people would maybe be afraid to touch others?
Yeah, there's certainly some police bystander CPR first, although we typically count that as a first responder CPR rather than a true bystander. And there's not a lot of those, frankly. They do respond to a lot of these cardiac arrests, but are rarely first on scene. So this is high, I think, because of our telecommunicator CPR. So we have, you know, dispatchers that are able to recognize the cardiac arrest, get the caller to start CPR at high rates. And as Helen mentioned, some of these differences between 56% and 70%, that could be a temporal trend in the overall bystander CPR rate, but there may be a data element to it in that we relied on the paramedics electronic patient care report at first to document bystander CPR and assumed it was negative if not documented. Whereas in 2016, we started collecting the dispatch calls and listening to them and coding the bystander CPR based on what we were hearing on the dispatch call, which was, you know, closer to reality probably. So we improved the accuracy of our database over time. We also started giving feedback to the dispatchers at that time. So once we had the calls and could listen to them, we could say, hey, you did a great job starting bystander CPR, or oops, here's a missed opportunity to start bystander CPR. So probably the combination of those things leads to both a real and a misclassification error effect in the big difference between the two cohorts. But it is a good bystander CPR, right? We're very happy with that. And it's getting closer to Scandinavian levels than, usual municipalities in the United States.
Absolutely. I think that's excellent. I mean, really good to hear about the work that you're doing with bystander CPR and partnering with dispatch. I can't imagine listening to all those recordings too. That must have been a lot of work for you and your research team, but really providing that follow-up and feedback with dispatchers who are truly the first responders there to these cardiac arrests is critical. So just want to commend you on that again.
And I'm a stats nerd, so I can't resist the question that came in from the audience here, talking about whether or not there was statistical significance for bystander CPR. So I'm going to take this one. I think it is important to ask this question, but it's interesting. Take a look at table one here. We don't have a column for p-values. Oh my. But as a meth stats editor for a lot of journals, I can tell you that there's a movement now away from p-values, especially in a table one. And the underlying rationale is that we fall into this false sense of security around a p-value, right? If it's not significant, okay, we can ignore it. But sometimes that's not true. And then the opposite also true. If it is significant, oh, now there's something big here that is really, really, really important, which also may not always be true. So I like that this journal and these authors have left the p-value out of a table one. This study was a convenient sample of what was available. And it wasn't, you know, there was no sample size calculation to perform here. This is what the data were. And so not having the p-value here allows the readers to observe these and say, well, do I think that there's a clinically meaningful difference here? And so we look at the rates and see 50 something versus 70 something and ask ourselves, is there clinical relevance? And I think the answer is yes. And that's good for us to keep in mind. And as we move into the models that can adjust for some of these things, it's important. But there's definitely, you'll see more often in a lot of the journals, this movement away from having the p-value as this thing that tells us, yes, we should believe it or no, we shouldn't believe it, as, you know, the end all be all, and instead considering what the effects were. All right, that's absolutely. My stats.
That is why we adjust for covariables in this type of study. You know, these differences aren't due to random chance because patients were selected at random. These right. differences are due to differences in the time in which these cardiac arrests occurred and other things that have changed over time. So that's why we do have to adjust statistically to try to get closer to the truth of the matter here.
Yeah, and I love it. I think this is an important conversation for us to have. And a lot of us were taught p-values in school, and we think that they're super important, but there's less of an emphasis now and more of an emphasis on understanding the context where the data came from. But I will get off the statistics because I could go all day and nobody wants to listen to me do that. So let's talk about some of the results. One of your secondary outcomes was, or one of the impetus for doing this study was the idea that IM-EPI is probably going to reduce time to EPI overall. So perhaps you can walk us through what you saw in terms of, was this hypothesis true? Did we get EPI earlier with the introduction of an IM protocol? So either Dr. Youngquist or Dr. Palatinas, perhaps you can talk to us a little bit about those descriptive results in terms of was EPI on board earlier?
Helen, do you want to take that?
Sure. Yes, we did see differences in the administration of the first dose of epinephrine, about a 3-minute difference or 3 to 4 minute difference between the two cohorts.
Yes, I think it was on the table one, if you want to go back at the bottom, is the interval from EMS arrival to first adrenaline dose, 7.8 minutes in the IVIO cohort versus 4.3 in the IM cohort. So it's absolutely pretty close to after two rhythm analyses on average.
Right. And that fits with what was expected. That was definitely a big time drop that we saw there. And into the result that everybody's really hungry for, I want to take a look at table two now and talk a little bit about what you saw in terms of your primary outcome, the survival to hospital admission and, well, survival to hospital discharge, the primary outcome, and then other outcomes of survival to hospital admission and then neurologically intact survival. What'd y'all find?
Yeah, so looking at all three outcomes, we saw a statistically significant difference between the treatment group and the standard of care cohort. For survival to hospital discharge, there was a difference, about 4% difference in survival to hospital discharge from between the two groups in both the unadjusted and adjusted models.
Yeah, I think that's a big change to keep an eye on. And I like that you all looked at the adjusted and the unadjusted. The effects hold true also in the adjusted model. So taking into account some of those differences that we can't control, temporality, populations change, these effects held true. I also like that you all took on a series of sensitivity analyses after this, because, you know, as good researchers and asking our questions and with the humility of, is this true? You all looked at the analysis a couple of different ways. So table three has the intention to treat analysis. And perhaps you can talk to us a little bit about what that was and whether or not the findings held true when we look at the data in a slightly different way.
Yeah, so there was, as we have noted earlier, there was only 89% compliance with the new protocol. So we wanted to take into consideration whether or not there was some selection bias in terms of how the EMS providers were treating these patients. So the initial primary analysis took a per protocol approach where all patients that were treated with the new interventions were included into the after phase. And then those that were treated the traditional IVIO route were included into the before phase. Table three uses an attention to treat analysis where all patients who were assigned to a certain or who received an intervention during the after phase were included into the intervention group, and those that were treated during the before phase were included into the before phase, regardless of whether or not the EMS provider adhered to the protocol. And with that analysis, we also continued to see that it was statistically significant.
Absolutely. And so there we start to build a degree of belief around this. The more ways that we look at the data and that we consider this, it starts to build this, okay, I think this is holding true. It's probably not just due to random variation. There's probably something to see here. And then there was a third way that the data were looked at in a sensitivity analysis, and that was table four is excluding the non-compliant cases. And what did you all find when you excluded the cases where protocol was not adhered to?
When we excluded those patients for the entire analysis, we continued to see a positive treatment effect within the IM epinephrine groups.
Yes. So for those who are listening, what we see here is slicing the data in different ways and following some best practices around whether treatment was given, whether there was intention to treat, taking into account that there might be some challenges with following a new protocol. We see consistency in the effect sizes, which is one of the tenets in epidemiology around, okay, we're starting to see something going on here and we should definitely pay attention for more. And so I'll invite our other panelists back in to let's start talking about the implications of these results. Now we have these results. I'm really excited about them. Not only do you have statistical significance, I think many would argue that 5 percentage point differences, 4 percentage point differences in a condition like cardiac arrest, that's really clinically relevant. That's people walking home from the hospital who otherwise would not have. And so some of the implications on this that I'm very interested in were, what was the feedback like from your clinicians at implementing this protocol, during this protocol, and now after seeing the results?
So we probably could have surveyed them to get more than an anecdotal sense of their attitudes toward this. But when we laid it out for them as, you know, epinephrine saves lives, the earlier you give it, the better. Giving it intramuscularly is the earliest we can think of, earliest way we can think of giving it right now. They seem to understand and get it. We didn't get a lot of like, oh, this is a really stupid idea, or why would you ever want to do this? I suppose if some of the paramedics thought that, they just kept it to themselves and didn't tell me about it, but they seem to be accepting of it. And I think now people are excited that it does seem to make a difference now that we've gone through the process of studying it, looking at the feasibility and the association with outcomes. I'd say people are pleasantly, you know, happy with our results.
Absolutely. Anytime we find an intervention like this where we can get the data back and see the results, and having that outcome data is so important, I think that generates a lot of excitement, and not just within your agency, but with agencies across the nation as well. I'm also curious about, you mentioned that this was initially rolled out to the ALS clinicians. Now, as these results come in and as your degree of certainty goes up around whether this is making a difference, do you have plans to expand this for BLS, or what are the considerations that go with that?
We do. We have actually started to look at the feasibility of BLS providers administering this medication. We've had maybe 10 uses so far by our BLS providers. All were appropriate, but we're monitoring it closely just because we can save an additional couple of minutes by giving it with BLS providers when they're first on scene. And they're first on scene somewhere around 30% of the time in our system. If we go outside of the metropolitan area of what's called the Wasatch Front here in Utah, which is the heavily populated area, the rest of the state is rural frontier. There are mostly BLS providers in those areas. And so I think it's important to look at this as a potential BLS intervention as well. So we've started that phase of studying this. Ultimately, we need a randomized trial to look at this because, you know, it's possible we handed the paramedics something new to do and they just got really excited and did better overall at resuscitating patients because now they had something cool to do. So it would have been nice if half of the time they had a placebo and they didn't know it in their hands and were injecting saline into the muscle, and that would be a way to really get to the bottom of this. And that's something yet to be done that needs to be done. And so we're focusing also on a clinical trial that evaluates this more meticulously with a placebo controlled arm.
That's very exciting to hear. And I think a lot of times we might look at an observational study and think, oh, well, you know, we can't make clinical decisions off an observational study, all these things. But what this study really does is sets up for, there is an effect here, there's something to see, and it warrants the time and the effort and the investment to have a randomized control trial to look at this further. So I think this is a great natural progression, and we'll be definitely on the lookout for those results and hope to invite you back when they're ready.
Sounds good.
Okay, you heard it. They committed. No, just kidding. But we would be very excited. I know that some of our other panelists have questions. I could ask a million more. But Dr. Toon, I'm going to hand it over to you and listen to some of your questions.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you. I've enjoyed, like everyone else, the study and the work that you did here. But I have I only thought about some of these questions as I heard you talk. So just your time to first medication, is that based upon, what is that interval? How is it measured? Is it based upon wheels stopped or patient contact?
That is CAD scene arrival. So it's not at patient. Unfortunately, the at patient time is recorded variably for us. So like most EMS agencies, this is, you know, if they call in an at patient time, then dispatch records it in CAD. Otherwise, it's not recorded. And so we only have EMS scene arrival times to go off of. So it's scene arrival time to medication administration.
And the medication, when they're documenting it, it's the time they document.
Correct. Yeah. So this, you know, involves the, you know, fidelity of their flow sheets. This is clearly not a, you know, something that's measured with quantum precision. This has a lot of measurement error in the timing, since paramedics are variably, you know, putting this in accurately. So, but that's all we have to go on. We don't have a drone flying overhead that we can, you know, time it exactly. So take the time with a grain of salt.
No, I just, again, curious. And then the actual preparation of the IM medication, how is it? Is it pre-drawn? So all they literally have to do is take out an alcohol prep, clean the site, jab it in? Or is there a prep time?
There is a prep time. So it is drawn up from a vial. And the reason for not pre-drawing it is that the pharmacologists tell us that it will degrade much faster, like within a matter of a week, if you draw it into a syringe and just have a syringe of epinephrine sitting there. So that was why we didn't do that. You know, it'd be nice to have a pre-filled auto injector or something like this for the study that, you know, is dark, protected from the light, and that sort of stuff. But that's just not available. And the only concentration available to us outside of an auto injector is 1 milligram per ml.
Okay. And then I'll finish up with this because I'm sure some of the other folks have some questions. So when it at the same time, so the crew comes in, begins to go through their process and assign their pit crew thing. So that means that the someone is trying to get vascular access at the same time someone's concentrating on the IM, correct?
Yes. So this particular approach requires a lot of hands on scene. So initially there's 4 hands on scene, all taking this pit crew approach. And later there's more like 8 to 10.
But would the priority still be, did you ask them to prioritize, particularly in those early moments, did you ask them to prioritize drawing up the IM and not worrying about the vascular access and letting someone else come along and take care of that?
We told them to try to run things in parallel. So if there was only one person that could do medication administration, then they would give the injection first and then establish the IO. If we had enough on scene, then someone would be drilling basically or trying to get an IV while the other person was injecting.
Okay, thank you very much. Beautiful work. I've enjoyed listening to this and then reading it.
Just wanted to piggyback on Dr. Toon's questions about the actual logistics of giving this intramuscular injection. So I was thinking about that volume and the 5 milliliters into that vastus lateralis. I know in most literature, 5 milliliters is really that upper limit when it comes to adults. And obviously children, it's much smaller, but many of our cardiac arrest patients are older, more frail, might be kind of malnourished, have less muscle volume. I was wondering if you got any feedback from the EMS clinicians that sometimes they just couldn't get this 5 milliliters in, or it would leak out. The muscle wouldn't really take it. So maybe they had to split it and give it bilaterally on instead of on one side. I don't know if you had any issues sort of operationalizing it.
We didn't have any feedback in that regards. Mm-hmm. if that was observed, it didn't come back to us that that had happened. I don't want people to be confused that I think the intramuscular route is superior to IV or IO. That's not the point of this. The point is to get some pressor effect early in the resuscitation to hopefully limit the low flow time of the cardiac arrest. We know the longer you're in cardiac arrest, the worse your overall outcome is. So it's far better to get return of spontaneous circulation in 5 minutes or 10 minutes than it is at 15 or 20 minutes. And we also don't know, you know, if what we're observing is an effect of the early administration and vasopressor effect that's occurring before the IO or IV, or if this is some sort of additive intervention. In other words, it might be smoothing out the peaks and troughs of bolus administration. There's a lot yet to study about this. So like you said, raises a lot more questions than it provides answers. But, we told them if you've got IV access, then there is no reason to give an IM, right? You should just go straight to the preferred route. So I don't doubt that there's high variability in the absorption and in patients in cardiac arrest. If we could measure blood levels, it'd be super interesting, but we just don't have that data.
Next study on the next one.
We'll look at that. That'll be tough to do.
Excellent. And speaking a little bit about Epi, so definitely the paramedics to trial, your trial certainly demonstrates the benefits of epinephrine, but it's still remains somewhat controversial in the literature as far as utilizing Epi and potential negative cerebral effects. And I know some systems are not always using Epi and are not necessarily following the American Heart Association ACLS guidelines, which your system uses. And some are withholding Epi in cases where there is a palpable pulse with chest compressions. I was wondering if you've thought at all of sort of any changes in terms of not giving all cardiac arrest patients Epi, but maybe only a subset or withholding it in the subset and where this might fit in.
Yeah, no, I mean, the hard part is we really don't know what I would call the patient's adrenergic integrity, meaning how much, when you have a cardiac arrest, at least early on, most people will release a bunch of endogenous epinephrine into their system. And so in our study, when we looked at subgroups of shockable and non-shockable rhythms, the shockable patients, there was an effect that was observed, but it was not statistically significant, although the effect was statistically significant in non-shockable rhythms. And one way, just guessing why this might be, is that patients who have ventricular fibrillation are more recently collapsed and probably have a lot of endogenous or their body's own epinephrine that can be circulated with chest compression. So the additive effect of giving more epinephrine to that patient may be substantially less than in a PEA or asystolic patient. Now, does epi injure the brain. A summary that Robert Berg, who's a researcher, did in a paper was that in the laboratory, epinephrine improves cerebral blood flow, cerebral oxygenation, and it does increase myocardial oxygen demand, or the demand that your heart needs more oxygen, but it also increases the supply as well. So it's a complicated molecule. And it is true that when we give it, there are more brain injured patients that we get back in cardiac arrest. But you know, you have to remember that when ECMO came on the scene, suddenly we were getting patients surviving that we had never seen before. These are the sickest patients. And so there's some spectrum bias when you resuscitate somebody and you get a return of spontaneous circulation that at higher rates with epinephrine, you're bound to see more brain injured patients, because you're also going to bring back patients who have had prolonged no flow times to their brains. That doesn't rule out a possibility that epinephrine is harmful for the brain, but what we're also seeing is patients getting a pulse back that we wouldn't get a pulse back on with a placebo, if that makes sense. So if we could show up and scan their brains and say, hey, don't give epi to this person because you really don't want to get them back, that would be a reasonable approach. But right now, we're just, until we get better information on epinephrine about whether withholding it in certain patients is the right thing to do, then we'll just continue to give it to everybody. So that's my personal thinking on this, but I'm open to other people publishing new results that's going to change the paradigm on epi dosing. If you look at the observational data, epi dosing that's more frequent seems to be associated with better outcomes. So when paramedics give it every 2 minutes, they get better outcomes than every 3 to 5 minutes. So there's a signal there with epinephrine for survival, for sure, not just from the paramedic 2 trial, but the observational literature is that your survival goes down 4 to 6% every minute that elapses before you get to that first dose. That's a pretty substantial decline in survival. So I don't want to come off as totally pro-epinephrine, but I don't see strong evidence that it's harming the brain. I see a lot of evidence that it's bringing back patients that have brain injury that we just can't deal with modern technology.
Yeah, that sounds great. And what I'm hearing is that more research is needed, that's always, but it sounds like you have a ton of excellent research ideas, and we're definitely looking forward to hearing what's next from Salt Lake City, since there's a lot of remaining questions and where do we take this? Where does this fit into the evolving cardiac arrest, pre-hospital care paradigm? So sounds like a lot of good things probably in the works.
We hope so.
Definitely. And I have this super unpopular task of wrapping us up, as the hour has absolutely flown by. I will give the authors rights to the last comments, last words. If there are any things that you would advise our listeners on, if they're going to, you know, implement a protocol like this or read this study, are there any last takeaways that you would like for them, or something that you're really excited to answer in the near future that we should be keeping in mind? I will start with you, Dr. Youngquist, and then pass to Dr. Palatinas, and I will carry us out from there.
Well, I would say anytime we change protocols, it's an opportunity. And it's an opportunity to figure out whether we're making things better or worse as best we can. That can be a difficult task for sure with observing effects, but I think it's imperative that we do so, unless that change is something that's already been proven by somebody else. So if that's a proven intervention, I think it's okay to adopt that without having to look at it critically. But if it's a change in the system that we don't know exactly what's going to happen with this, but we think it's the right thing, then we should study it.
Absolutely.
And I agree with Scott. I think definitely something we can continue pursuing, and certainly in the setting of a randomized controlled trial.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you both again for your work in this space. It is no easy feat to have a publication, resuscitation, and to do the work that went into this. So thank you for your time there, and thank you for sharing your time here with our audience. I unfortunately do have to carry us out because we are at the top of the hour, but for our audience, just to remind you all, We've got the Education Research Journal Club podcast coming up later this month, September 27th. And we will be back here again next month with the clinical podcast, second Monday of the month, October 14th. Thank you to our authors one more time. Big round of applause, and we'll continue to listen to this. And thank you all for tuning in live. We will catch you on the next one.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.